Delays and the driving delay. We are finally on schedule. Yay!
No one knows that we're not on schedule, to be fair.
Oh, that's
outside
true.
Of us.
That's true. I just notified everybody. Yay, we're always on schedule. Woohoo! All right. So, thank you for listening to the Bloody Mary podcast, where we talk about terrible women in history and folklore. And our topic for today, the name of the terrible lady. It sounds a lot like how my Vietnamese aunt says Santa Claus, Sante Kynes.
And our guest today is the great, the wonderful Michael Skarsen.
Howdy, howdy. Ooh. Bloody Maryer. Do you guys have a fan name yet?
No.
No.
I think Bloody Maryer is on the bottom of the list.
I guess we could call them Bloodies or Bloodiers.
Or just Marys. There's two.
Marys is good.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Have you guys drank in Bloody Marys while you've done this? Do you guys drink?
Oh, I do.
I've always thought about doing that, but then I never get my shit together enough to actually bring Bloody Marys or talk about.
It's also never during the day. And I feel like a Bloody Mary is almost a day drink.
Right.
Like a brunch drink.
Yeah. Yeah. Bloody Marys during the day is like fun and frisky. Bloody Marys at night, you've killed somebody.
Right.
And you're like contemplating your life choices afterwards.
Yeah. So I think Michael's right. We should have them then.
Yeah.
I mean, it's on theme.
All right. So our Sante Kynes. Now, this is a theme that I feel like I've had throughout most of the people I've picked, because this is my topic for today, is that I pick somebody and I think this is going to be pretty easy. This is going to be like a one-off. And then it ends up being like this whole like other story that I'm just like, what the hell? And that's Sante Kynes in a nutshell.
Yeah. Her I feel and like her son.
Her and her son, Kenneth, who, by the way, nobody good is named Kenneth. I feel like that we can just do a Bloody Mary blanket statement.
Well, what about Kenneth from 30 Rock?
Right. That's where that's the only Kenneth I think of.
He lived forever and he possibly killed his roommate. So
yeah, but okay. But his living forever doesn't make you a bad person.
Okay. I would say nobody not creepy is named Kenneth.
That's true.
Can I confess something? I didn't look up much of this because I wanted to be fine, but Maria had the documentary running before it, and I think Kenneth is kind of attractive.
Oh!
She has two sons, Kenneth and Kent.
Yeah.
And they're both super hot.
Yeah.
They're super hot.
Like Jesus Christ.
And also, Sante is very attractive, too.
When she was younger, she was very pretty.
Yeah.
But then I feel like she was one of those ladies that stay thinking she was hot into her 60s and 70s.
She also was one of those women who got in that trap of trying to look like Elizabeth Taylor.
Yes.
When,
which she used as a trap, but we'll get to it.
Which, like, didn't, like, way past the time when she even resembled Elizabeth Taylor. You know, like, my grandma got in that trap, too, where she would wear wigs and stuff and, like, jewelry, and she would pretend that she was, like, look like Elizabeth Taylor, and I'd be like, Grandma, you're going to dialysis. Like, cool your jets. You don't need to put on full makeup right now. So just to do a summary of Sante Kynes. Sante Kynes, with the help of her husband Kenneth Sr. and then also her son Kenneth Jr., committed two murders, a robbery, a violation of anti-slavery laws, forgery, and numerous other crimes. Kenneth Jr. and Sante were tried and convicted in 1998 for the murder of Irene Silverman. The pair were also suspected but never charged in a third murder in the Bahamas, which Kenneth later confessed to. Kynes was sentenced to 125 years in prison in New York on June 27, 2000, and life in prison in California in 2004. So, Sante Kynes was born July 24th, 1934 in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, and she died May 19th, 2014 in Bedford Hills, New York. her, she had multiple names. She had, she was known as Sandra Walker, Shante Kime, Sante Jenkins, Sandy Chambers. Those are kind of the names that she went
like
by.
I heard, when I heard that, I felt like none of them were that far away
no.
from her original name.
Yeah. It's like what's her original name is Sante Kimes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Her original name was that we think was Sante Jenkins.
Mm. Oh, her maiden name, right?
Yeah, but she also, there was another report that said that her original name was like Sandra Louise Walker.
I also have Sandra Louise Singers.
Oh, Singers? Yeah, yeah. Maybe that's, yeah. So she changed her name a bunch depending on like where she was in status wise. So her parents were a partial Dutch mother named Mary Van Horn and an East Indian father named Prama Singer. She was married several times, once to a millionaire motel owner who made motels in Anaheim, which we'll get to. So her early life, her parents met at a state fair where Prama was performing in a magic show. He was also an he was also an herb doctor and a vaudeville magician, which I feel like is just like, hey, like just throwing balls in the air and being like,
yeah, he's just a swindler.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, okay, he's an herb doctor, a vaudeville magician, a tightrope artist.
Yeah. Yeah. And he also gets spots out of your clothes. And he can make the best omelet. Mary, which I read two articles, which notified Mary, said that Mary was a housewife before she was even married. She was living with her father. She was called a housewife, which I thought was interesting. So it just seemed like back then women were just like, yeah, they're pretty much just housewife in training.
Right.
Yeah.
It's just a blanket statement for woman.
Yeah.
Housewife.
Yeah, basically.
Even her daughter, Sante's sister, Sandra, said about her mom that, like, she was like, my mom was very passive. And you could always tell her what to do. And she was born to be told what to do.
Yeah. I love those were her benefits. Those were her compliments about her mother. She was passive and easily controlled.
Yeah. It's nuts. I mean, that's it. Who knows what happened there, but yeah, it's really funny.
I know. Her father, her grandfather, Sante's grandfather, Mary's father, was a Presbyterian minister and did not approve of Mary marrying an Indian, which I feel like
a magician.
Yeah. That's witchcraft.
Oh, yeah, all the witchcraft.
I wonder what he was upset at more. If she's Dad, I'm marrying a magician. Ugh. And he's Indian. Or if it was, Dad, I'm marrying an Indian. Ugh. And he's a magician. Oh, God.
I feel like she probably left out the magician part as long as she just picked one of his other occupations to say, like, Dad, he's a doctor. What kind of doctor? An herb doctor?
Yeah. The good kind. So what I thought was interesting was that they married like within weeks of knowing each other.
Well, he's a circus man. Maybe he's got to go. He's got places to be.
I have an ex who weeks after we broke up, literally joined the circus.
What?
Yeah.
That's really? Crazy.
Yeah. She's all over Instagram now. Not popular on Instagram, but she's one of those rope dancers.
Did she show any interest in being in the circus when you guys
I mean, she was always I think she did like bouffant classes and stuff, like clowning stuff and shit like that. And she was always very like animated and stuff like that. And it's a very good fit for her.
She would enter the room by doing a cartwheel.
Yeah. And she'd tame her cat in the living room and stuff like that. But yeah.
Oh, wow.
Did she ever say it was like because of you or anything?
No,
like,
okay. We were very young too. I mean, okay.
Last year.
I feel like when you're super young, I mean, I feel like maybe when you break ups later in life, you do this too. But like she did all the things, like she dyed her hair blue. Got a dog, joined the circus.
Oh my gosh, did it all at once.
Yeah.
Fucked her up.
Yeah, those are the stages of grief.
Right, yeah. I'm going to change my hair.
Get a pet, join an institution.
Somebody will love me, yeah.
Yeah. So they got married within weeks of knowing each other. The only reason why I think that's crazy is that they come from two different backgrounds. And this is the time when that's considered more of a thing than right now.
Right.
And they just totally were like, F it, let's go for it.
That's love.
I know.
I guess she was like ready to be a housewife. She was ready to be married.
Yeah, she had been a housewife for years.
So this is just a wonderful story that ends right there.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. This is a beautiful love story. Let's not forget that this is a beautiful love story. So they moved to Oklahoma. They bought a farm with the herb money, magician herb money. They had four children. They had a son, their firstborn, Karam, a daughter named Premi, who I feel like was a preemie, and they were just like, okay, I know what we're going to name her.
Or the doctor. This was in Oklahoma?
Yeah.
So I came and was like, that's a preemie. Yeah.
Exactly. And they were just like, you named him for us. And then Sante, who was the second daughter, who they made a reference in that documentary that the biography that she was like considered the baby of the family, and then Retha came along. So essentially the youngest Retha was sort of like the kind of upended her like babe, you know, pampered lifestyle already, which is why later in life she gets most of her, or when they were children, she gets most of her abuse. So, and then also one of the things is right after Retha passed away, or not Retha, right after Retha was born, the father died from a heart disease. So the mother, Mary, was left to kind of take care of four kids all by herself. So she was already, you know, passive and easily controlled. So Mary cleaned houses and took in laundry for money. And then while she was doing that, Karam, the son, and Premi took care of Sante and Retha while the mother was at work. However, quickly, Karam and Sante began to have an uncomfortably close relationship.
Yeah, it was gross.
Retha said she would catch them like sitting on each other's, Sante sitting on her brother's lap, giving him kisses, them holding each other in weird ways, which I'm assuming was like him holding her by the vagina.
Yeah, that's what I asked, because she was like, I would see his hand in places where it shouldn't be. And like, well, what it was like, he was literally like between her legs. And how old is he? And how old is she at this point?
They're not. Well, the brother is in his late teen to middle teens.
Oh, okay.
So the daughter must be like, I don't know, like in not probably not even 10, or like less than 10. Maybe like not 8 or 7 or 8. So
and he was also really controlling,
extremely controlling, and violent
to the point where he beat his mom.
He beat his mom. Wow. And so one time they got in this huge fight. He punches his mother in the face, steals her wedding ring and any other monetary valuables that they had that are in the house, and just leaves. He's never heard from again. And then a couple days later, Premi, the second oldest child, does the same thing and leaves. So it's just Sante, Retha, and the mother.
So she took the second round of jewels.
She took the toaster oven.
Yeah, the forks.
Yeah, she just cleaned them out again. They were like, we finally got back everything we lost. So
now it's just Sante and Retha.
Retha. So then Sante kind of took over as the aggressor. She was kind of the violent one, and she really kind of started abusing her sister. She would do things like say, it's time for the fire, which is what Retha said that Sante would say in like a creepy voice.
Right.
And she would take a match, light it, and put it up to her fingers. And if Retha like moved or cried or anything, she would do it over and over again. Which I did that to myself, but like when I was a kid.
Just to like to see your pain tolerance?
Just to see my pain tolerance. I didn't last very long.
Right.
But I just find it funny that like I was listening to this, because there's another time where they talk about her doing this thing called hot feet, which is where you take a match, a lit, and you put it up between somebody's toes. Mm. And I did that to myself. I was like, oh my God, like, what's wrong with me?
Yeah,
like,
what is wrong
like,
with
I
you?
I thought that I was just like, oh, I'm just figuring my pain tolerance.
I mean, I guess it's better that you did it to yourself and not to a little
sister. Well, I also did it to my brother. But like, it was more like a, let's see how far we can go with this, you know?
I guess that's how Sante felt too.
I feel like this is another moment where I share something about myself that I realize is actually terrible.
Oh, no.
No, it's fine. Take the matches away from Lori.
Yeah. She also used to abuse animals. She would tie up goats and put pins up their butts, hat pins up their butts. And then she would also catch dogs and put clothespins on their ears, nose, and genitals. Which was gross.
Well, and this could be if she was like being abused by her brother and stuff.
It's all transference.
Right.
Yeah. Was their father abusive?
They didn't say.
They didn't seem, through all the research we did, we couldn't find anything that said that the father was like this. It just kind of started with the brother.
Yeah. And I watched an interview she did with Larry King, and she didn't even really talk about her family that much. She said in her interview, which, I mean, you could trust that as far as you can throw it, but she said that she was homeless for most of her childhood.
Well, she lies a lot about her childhood. It's just part of the con game again of like, the more sympathy you can garner about anything like that, the more you will.
I agree, but I would say that if I was abused by a family member, I feel like being abused is more sympathetic than being homeless. Don't you think like you would be like, I was little, abused?
But then, like, as we'll see later on, she does the same thing to her kids.
Oh, that's true.
So she doesn't see it as wrong.
So she was like kind of the boss around her house, but then at school she was teased and ostracized for being Indian. And so she kind of had to deal with that neglect as well. Plus, I guess that her mom kind of wasn't really doing much at that time because
is she doing a lot? No, I'm sorry.
Exactly. And so the authorities took the girls and put them in a home for girls because they felt like they were being neglected. And then that's when the mom was like, nope, I'm going to break you guys out and we're going to move to California. So they move to California and they move into an apartment above a factory. And during that time, Sante kind of just eventually becomes more and more aggressive because she just realizes that if she doesn't get what she wants or if people don't agree with her, she can just throw a fit and then people will just agree with her or give her what she wants. Mm-hmm. So, but that's only with her family. With outside people, she's sort of like this very charming, very kind person.
Right.
And so she befriends this couple who own a soda shop and a movie theater. And they feel like, oh, well, all she needs is like a stable life. And so the wife of that couple talks to her sister and says, hey, you should adopt this little girl. She's, she's just looking for a good home. So they adopt her, Mary and Ed Chambers, and they move to Carson City, Nevada. And Mary was a bookkeeper and Ed worked for Nevada's National Guard, but had a little bit of a drinking problem. So at 12, she was adopted by this family and she moved in with them. And they also had another adopted son named Howard, but Howard isn't really mentioned in anything else that I read or saw. So I don't know.
Probably normal.
When my grandmother got remarried, my dad had a stepsister and like, it's totally different from any other stepsister, stepbrother relationship that I've ever encountered because they literally didn't talk to each other the entire time that they were. And my brother was like 13.
Right.
And so he just was like, yeah, we had just had nothing in common. She was 17. I was 13. I just stayed in my room and she just stayed in her room. And I was just like.
And in this case, they're both foster like children or like adopted children. So yeah, they don't even have like a duty.
Yeah.
You don't feel like you have to like grow a bond with this person kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I kind of feel like maybe because you live in the same place, you feel like you should.
Yeah, but it's more like it's like a roommate, You don't.
I think the shared experience of being a foster child. Like, that's something everybody. I was talking to my roommate sober. I'm sober, and we're talking like I'll meet somebody and I'll be like, I fucking hate that guy, and they'll be like, I'm in the program, and I'll be like, oh, we're best friends now.
Yeah,
yeah. Like, we're cool. Yeah,
yeah.
Like I feel like those shared experiences should build a bond.
Maybe what was his name? Harold?
Howard. Yeah.
I think Howard immediately was like, this bitch is insane.
Right. Yeah. Fuck probably. That. Yeah.
No.
Just like I'm
you're
just
gonna ruin everything for me.
Yeah. I'm gonna lock my doors. I'm never gonna talk to you. So things totally changed for Sante after that. She changed her name to Sandy Chambers because this family was like an affluent member of the community. Yeah. She was able to buy things. She bought nice clothes. She started using white powder to cover up her olive skin,
which is crazy because she was really light skinned as is.
Yeah.
And she would wear white powder on top of that.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It just like when I saw the pictures of her and I was like, I don't see.
Yeah.
She could have just had a nice tan is what it looked like without the powder.
Yeah.
And at this point, it's the 70s or the 80s? It's the 80s, right?
It's the 70s.
And her name is Sandy Chambers.
she should have a tan.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever. That's just a whole nother.
I think that's just her own insecurities. Yeah.
I was going to say identity problem.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So she had her own room. She had her own clothes and everything, but she still like wanted more. And this is going to be like a growing theme throughout Sante's life is that she has money. She has means, but she can't help herself. She still wants more. So she starts stealing things.
Right.
Even though she can afford. So she gets in trouble and she starts stealing lipsticks and she starts stealing like coats and clothes, but she can afford them. You know, she like goes shopping with her friends.
It's like when Winona Ryder.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, so. This is kind of, people always talk about the trifecta, right?
It's yes.
Like petty crimes, and then she's burning things with her friends, and she's hurting animals, or she's bedwetting.
It's bedwetting, fire starting, and hurting animals. It's called the McDonald's.
So we just don't know if she did bedwetting.
Which is, that's like, unusual for girls. So who knows? Hmm. Maybe her stealing is a way, another thing.
But she's also a teenager at this point, right?
Yeah, she's a teenager.
I feel like, did you ever see that movie 13?
No.
No?
I refuse to watch any coming
you
of
did,
age.
You did, Michael?
No, but I've read the Wikipedia article.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's
I do that. I read the synopsis on Wikipedia.
I do that all the time.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm not going to see Mandy. Let's see what, let's figure out what it's about.
I mean, there's nothing much to see with 13, but it was just like, I was going to use it as an example of like, girls just do that. They'll just like, oh, you want to be cool? You steal this lipstick.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I shoplifted as a kid just to like, be like, yeah, I'm badass.
Exactly.
I like stole a pen once for a homemade bong and I got arrested for it. And it was like an awful experience.
Did you have to get bailed out?
No, I didn't get arrested. I got
mall arrested.
And then my dad had to come. And he
that's the worst.
Yeah. And my dad's a wonderful, great human being and was like disappointed in me and like made me read some book by like, you know, I mean,
was it the Bible?
It was not the Bible. Oh, it was like some motivational self-help book. And he made me write like a essay to him about it and stuff. And then he took me out to get tacos and stuff. And it was a very nice memory that I just dredged up in therapy recently. Aww. Shout out to Grant Courtney,
my
therapist.
My mom just like scared the crap out of me about stealing when I was little. She would just say that. Like one time I went to reach for a grape and just the one solitary grape. She's like, if you do that, you're gonna get, I'm like five. She's like, you're gonna get arrested and you're gonna spend 5 days in jail and I'm not gonna come get you. And so that was enough for me to never want to shoplift for some reason. I just got scared. She was like, every little grape, every little chocolate that you try to steal, you'll go to jail.
I still steal fancy cheese sometimes from the grocery store.
Oh no, I steal now.
Yeah.
Now that my mom's not around.
I steal when like I feel slighted. So like I went to an electronics store and I was looking, I just needed a cord for my computer. And this guy was like not being helpful whatsoever and was like kind of being rude about it. Like he was like, well, you should know what kind of cord you want. And I was like, first off, I'm here asking you, why do you work here, you douchebag? Right. So I took a $300 speaker that I didn't need.
How'd you do it?
I just put it in my back. Well, so they
recently?
Like this was like last year.
Oh, okay.
I haven't been back there.
Which
I've just
store,
been,
which location?
Yeah, I haven't been back there, but I just took it because so they have this policy where they check your bags, but they only kind of just do a cursory look.
Yeah,
and I would just fill my bag with like so much tampons
that they
didn't want to look. So they'd just be like, okay, that's good. And so I would go in there a bunch, so they knew me, so they knew, oh, that's the tampon lady. So I used that to my advantage where I would go in there and I get upset. So I usually it was like cords. Like it took like a iPhone charger one time.
Right.
And so it wasn't like big thing. This is the biggest thing I ever took. And
good
I
for
just,
you.
Yeah. I just grabbed it and I went into the bathroom because you could take stuff into the bathroom, which I never understood. And they stopped that policy now, but you could take stuff in the bathroom if you wanted to. So I took it in the bathroom. I took off the packaging and I just stuffed it in my backpack. And then I walked out and I even was like, and to this day, I'm like, thank God they didn't check because I was being overly cocky. Like, I was like, you want to look through my bag? And like, I was like,
idiot.
Yeah. And I was just, and they were like, she was like, no, I'm fine. I'm fine. And I was like, if she had said yes, I would have been so effed because she would have just easily seen the speaker and she would have been like, where is your receipt for this? Why do you have a speaker in your backpack?
But then again, you're always there. So they could have been like, oh, she just has the speaker.
She bought it.
Yeah. So anyways, so yeah. So the, but yeah, I've just taken that. And then I think I, yeah.
I spite stole industrial mayonnaise thing from, I work for Jimmy John's and they didn't let me, like, I got the receipt, but like, it was like the customer, they signed the tip on the customer copy of the receipt, not the, like,
the merchant copy.
And they're like, yeah, well, you're out that $10. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to steal one of these Hellman's mayonnaise jars.
Oh, yeah.
It was like 10 pounds of Hellman's and mayonnaise doesn't last for like years. So
yeah,
I just,
yeah.
Every time I have to stay like an hour or two later at work, I spite steal like a nice pen. And I'm like, this is to pay back for this hour.
Right.
I know you're not paying me overtime for.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. Let's steal one office supply.
So while she was doing this, she was like popular. She had a friend who named Ruth who would like follow her around everywhere, who I'm pretty sure was a lesbian because she did everything that Sante said, and only really lesbians have that kind of devotion to a best friend. So I'm just come from experience. They would do things like they would dress in full cheerleading attire, which they weren't cheerleaders.
Yeah.
And they would go to outside games.
That's,
and they would run
on that is stolen valor.
Yeah, right. And they would run on the field and just join the cheer team. It was weird. Yeah. It was really
that's
weird.
That's kind of cute. I knew some girls in high school who were, we'll talk about that later. I knew some girls in high school, two sets of girls in high school that would do weird stuff like that together. And they were fun, but murderous too, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're next. They're our next topic.
So she graduated high school in 1952 and she moved to California with Ruth, who was never, you know, we don't hear from again, but I have a feeling that she, you know, eventually moved to San Francisco, if you know what I mean.
Confessor love.
Yeah.
Right.
Was not reciprocated. Work out.
There's chowder.
Yeah.
Red Bulls.
Yeah.
She quickly met and started dating a college senior named Lee Powers. And Lee was, they dated for a year and then he graduated college and decided to enlist in the army. And Sante wanted to get married. She had this dream of like being married and being in, you know, a rich housewife. So she told Lee that she was pregnant, which she wasn't.
No.
And yeah, I know, it's shocking. So Lee and Sante were married on May 9th, 1956, and he never addressed the pregnancy. It was like obvious that she wasn't pregnant and he never brought it up. But
because they were only married like 3 months, right?
They were married a year.
A year?
Yeah. Wow. They were married a year and she gets divorced, and then 6 months later he never
brings it up again?
Nope.
Like, he just gets married to her and then just like, yeah, waits a month or two for her belly to grow and
it doesn't, and then
he's just like, well, here I am.
Yeah.
Well,
but yeah. I have a feeling he's like an army guy, you know, so he's probably just like, I don't know, maybe she lost the baby. You know, women and their bodies. You know, like she, like.
Or he's terrified. I feel like I've been that guy in unhealthy relationships where I'm just like, well, I don't want to say anything that might make you mad, so I'm not going to bring up the lie about the pregnancy and we'll just kind of putter along here.
Oh, there might, like, when she got adopted from that family, Aretha says that her and her mother danced the day that she left.
She was that shitty of a daughter.
She was that
person to be around. We're like, they did a little dance.
Which I would have loved to see what that dance was. Like, was it like,
I don't know, but I hope it was to,
they
like,
invented the cha cha slide.
Yeah. Yeah, little people know. But so a year later, she was like, I'm done. Like, he's not making enough money. I'm not nowhere near where I want to be. So, she divorces him, and then 6 months later she marries a old high school boyfriend named Ed Walker, who on November 9th, 1957, so it was a quick turnaround. And Ed hit one of his big accomplished, or he was a general contractor who built homes in Sacramento, and he was also known as like a real like push around, even though he's like a big guy. Like, he was known as like a guy that she could control, which is kind of what she wanted. And he did well financially building homes, but not enough for Sante. Like, Sante wanted, you know, money. She wanted, like, all the money. So Ed started noticing around December 1960 that some of his homes that he built would like catch fire in weird ways. And so people would just chalk it up to like faulty wiring. Like they were saying, like it would be weird because it'd be like a iron would be plugged in one end and like some gas would be spilled on another end. So it's just like, why were these things happening? You know, like who spills gas and goes, oh, I gotta go iron real quick, you know? Right. So, and also Sante made sure that she was the one collecting the insurance
right.
for when the when for these homes.
And so he, how is he not noticing any of this is my question. Like, how is he not putting it together that she's probably like going up to him being like, oh, hey, honey, where are all your homes?
Yeah.
Where are they all? Yeah. And he's like, well, I got a couple in Nevada. I got a couple down in Victorville. And then the next day they start catching up.
He's just like, wow, that is interesting. Weird. I literally was just talking about that home with my wife. It's so interesting. Well, he did like, they say that he did kind of suspect that something was going on, but like, again, never confronted her about it.
So like, everyone's scared of her.
Yeah.
She seems like a terrifying person.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Like, hey, do you think I did this? You think I was the person who burned down the house? So I'm just a crazy person. Huh? I'm just a crazy person.
And she's good at turning stuff around because even in the interviews, like her Larry King interview and other interviews that she had leading up to her trial, the whole time all she does is blame the judicial system.
Oh, yeah.
And saying that, like, the police are corrupt and everybody in the courtroom is out to get her and her son. And it's always everybody else's fault.
Right.
Yeah. So I feel like she probably did that in relationships, too, of like, it's not my fault you built shitty houses.
Yeah. Yeah. So in December of 1962, she gave birth to her son, her first son, Kent Walker, who ended up writing a book about her called Son of a Grifter. And he actually said, you know, it's surprising, but she was a great mother. Which I thought was weird.
Yeah, like she showered him in gifts and he always had birthdays and she was very loving and all that. But then he does point out, he's like, they were probably all stolen. But
yeah.
All these gifts were covered in soot and gasoline.
Yeah, but it made you feel loved. So in 1967, Sante was like, you know what? I'm over this. Ed's not giving me the money and life that I want, even though she's burning houses left and right.
And collecting the money,
she's still not reaching the place that she wants. So she decides she's going to get divorced. She's going to get a millionaire. So she marries Kenneth. So she meets Kenneth Kime. She reads in a Millionaire magazine that there's a recently divorced real estate developer named Kenneth Kimes who's worth about $20 million. So she goes, that's where we need to be.
To be fair, all she's doing is her own version of The Bachelor.
Yes.
Tracking down a millionaire.
I also love that there's a Millionaires magazine. Like, that to me just cracks me up. It's like, come on, guys.
It could be called Suckers Magazine.
Oh,
they both high five me. They both high five
Bloody Mary podcast. Thank you very much. That's it. Thank you. We're done. We're ending the show
that's
early.
That's the best joke we got.
So she basically threw herself at him for a year. And in 1971, she moved in, her and Kent moved in with Kimes in Newport Beach. Now, there are contradicting reports because some people say that they never married because he was saying he knew that if they got married, that she would take every penny. So she decided that the best way to get control of him was to have a kid. So that's how she had Kenneth Kimes Jr. Now, other people are saying, even Kent say that they eventually did get married, but that he still didn't leave her any money. So that she knew that if anything were to happen to her, all of his money would be left to his first two kids, not Kenneth, and not Sante. So in 1975, they moved to Hawaii and Sante all of a sudden started having all these maids working for her. And maids in the island were hard to come by.
Mm-hmm.
So people were always astonished that she was able to find all these maids.
They were also nannies, right?
So and they were also, nannies. And they were just like, as soon as you walked in the door, there were like, uniformed people, servants there. You know, a bunch mm-hmm. of all of a lot of them. And Kent, her oldest son, said he never remembered her washing a dish. He never remembered her cleaning any clothes. So people were always wondering how she got them. Well, come to find out, she would go to Mexico and Venezuela and find young women and convince them to come with her for a better life. And she would move them into her house. She would give them money to save up to send back to her their families, and that they could work for her. Well, when they got to the house, she would say, if you try to leave, I will have you deported and I'll have your family arrested. And she would also abuse them and use intimidation. So they would work 7 days a week for 13 hours a day with no pay. So they're slaves. And she would also, they weren't allowed to leave the residence unless she went with them. And she also abused them in various ways. She kept under lock and key, so she would actually lock her in a cage and not allow her to leave. She also one time threw an iron and used an iron to burn a maid, several maids. She beat one maid with hangers. She would pour boiling water on maids.
These aren't maids, they're slaves.
They're slaves. She had slaves. So
sorry to interrupt, but do you know how she brought them over? Because they're illegal immigrants.
They're illegal immigrants, yeah.
How would she fly them back over? She's in Hawaii.
Yeah.
There's no way to get there by, walking.
I don't know. Yeah, it didn't say in any of my... I wish I had found that out, because that is a good question.
I wonder
question.
If she conned the airline, too, somehow. Because, back then it was easier. TSA rules were a lot more laxed.
Yeah.
She must have, I guess she conned them somehow, but it's crazy.
Yeah.
Because she did it over and over, and nobody...
Yeah, she said she had, in her life, she's had about, 80 to 100 maids.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Wow. So she had 80 to 100 slaves.
And then what happened to them after? After a while that they would just run away? Or how did they get away from her?
So she would just discard them. She would move from house to house. One of the big things was she still had her fire starting business. she would set fires to different houses and collect the insurance. So she still had that. So maids would just leave or mm-hmm. she would just get rid of them. So she would move from house to house. And then finally, they were getting in trouble in Hawaii. So they moved back to the mainland. And people knew, the authorities knew about this. They heard about these crimes that she was inflicting on these, these people, but they didn't do anything about it until 1985 when a slave essentially escaped and ran to the FBI.
Wow.
And basically said, hey, look, she's holding people hostage there.
Right.
So they were arrested. Kenneth Sr. and Sante were arrested.
And then they also deported the slave.
They deported the slaves. Yeah, they were like, let's take care of you guys and get you out of here real fast. But see, that was another big problem, is that these, even if they wanted to, they couldn't go to the authorities because they knew that as soon as they did, they would get deported.
Yeah.
So Sante was arrested. And so Kent was still lived in Hawaii. He was like, I'm done with her and her crazy behavior. I'm just going to live. So Kenneth Jr. and Kenneth Sr. and Sante moved back to Las Vegas. And then that's when they got arrested. And Kenneth Sr. and Sante got arrested. And Kenneth pleaded to, took a plea deal and said, yes, I knew that Sante was doing this, but
the arson
involuntary servitude to the so he got
so he was fine with it.
He was a huge alcoholic too. Was another thing, is that she was able to control him because he just had a huge drinking problem. Wow. She did a lot of grifting. She would lie to get him into places, and he would just be like, if there's booze, I'll go. So they one time she kept saying he was an ambassador, and she lied the way into meeting the Fords during the Ford administration. And he was just like, he was blitzed off his butt. So he's just like, I don't know what's going on. But she was just like, we're making contacts.
we're networking, baby. Yeah, yeah.
So he agreed to testify against her and also seek rehabilitation for his alcoholism. And he didn't get any jail time. Right. She had to plead guilty and do 5 years of jail time. So during that time, Kenneth Jr. kind of came out of his shell, because at that time
when Kenneth Senior's the alcoholic.
Yes.
Kenneth Senior, Kenneth Jr. still a child at this point.
He's teenager.
Yeah, he's like a preteen when she goes into prison, and then he kind of is like a late teen when she comes out.
Yeah.
And when Kenneth Jr. was born, he was kind of seen as her gem, her pride and joy. So she didn't want him to be around other kids. She didn't want him to be. So she would hire tutors to homeschool him. He also was almost like a spitting image, not like as far as like looks, because he looked a lot like his dad, but as far as like personality, he was exactly like his mother. He was charming, charismatic, but he also lied out of his ass.
Because she taught him how to lie.
Because he taught him how to lie. And she also taught him that there's a time and a place for lying.
Yeah.
Like one time his tutor noticed that Kenny had a problem with lying. So she read him the fable, Aesop's fable about the boy who cried wolf. And he was just like, oh, that's really cool. And then he told his mom about it. He's like, look at this story that my tutor just taught me. And she got so livid and went directly to the tutor and grabbed her and dragged her in the bedroom and threw her against the wall and said, don't you ever teach my child morals.
Yeah.
I teach my child morals.
It's crazy. That's like the real life version of the Addams Family. Like if the Addams Family were to be a real, like real group of people. Where like their whole thing is to do the opposite of what's good. This is her.
But the Addams Family is like actually kind of good.
Yeah, but
so like, this is like this would be like this would like, be the this is a realistic, I get what you're saying. Yeah,
this is a realistic version of that wouldn't exist in that in
the
this
new
world.
Netflix.
Yeah,
reboot.
Yeah, exactly. so now Kenneth Jr. Kenny essentially has like his mom's gone.
Yeah.
So he has his dad now, and his dad's always been like a backseat parent. So now his dad's like has to take over. And he decides that he's not going to do tutoring anymore. He's going to enlist him in high school. So Kenny goes to high school and he loves it. He's doing really well. He's making friends. His forces, him and his dad are getting along. However, one thing his dad keeps teaching him or telling him is never trust anybody. Everybody's out to get you.
Even your mom.
Especially your mom. So things are going pretty okay for Kenny. And then his mom gets out on parole in 1989.
Three years later. As opposed to 5 years later.
So Kenny's so upset that a childhood friend says that he was visibly crying when he found out that his mom was coming back into his life.
He's terrified.
Which is like, that's not a good thing. Like, it just shows the kind of impact that she has on people where it's like, he's so devoted to her, but then when she's gone, he's like, I'm free. I can finally be myself.
Right.
So he comes back, so she comes back into his life and she immediately takes him out of the high school that he's been at, moves into a separate high school and says you can no longer have any contact with the people you've been friends with because they're quote unquote bad influences.
Right.
So Kenny gets so frustrated with his mother because he at the time, you know, his dad was kind of letting him kind of be independent and his mom was completely different. His mom was like, no, you follow my rules. You do what I want you to do. So Kenny would like fly into rages and he would have like full on fights. And he even at one point, his brother said, Kent said that he plotted to kill his mother because he was so mad with her.
Mm.
That all changes when he graduates high school. He goes to Cal State Santa Barbara and he's doing okay. But then in 1994, first year into college, his dad just drops dead of an aneurysm. So that kind of everything shifts. So now he's lost his dad and his mom has lost her husband, essentially. And
she doesn't care.
I don't know.
Don't say it like she cares. Like, she's just like, the only thing she cares is that she lost is the possibility of getting his money.
Now. Yeah, I could see. Yeah. I mean, I feel like she kind of like, you know, she, there's a thing to say that she like loved his money. So she kind of like, that's her
version of love.
So that's her version of love. So she lost that kind of, she lost her soulmate there, which was his money.
The money, the wallet.
So Kenny drops out of college and him and his mom start a business where they sell Cuban cigars over the internet.
And this is the 90s, right?
This is in the 90s.
The internet is new.
Yeah. And that's because, so they basically immediately start grifting.
Right.
Because that's because Ken Sr. basically wrote it out in his will that Sante and Kenny didn't get anything. All of his money went to his first two kids, which he said from the beginning that was going to happen. Immediately, what they start panicking and they start trying to do cons and grifts. And so they fly to the Bahamas to try and take out money, secretly take out money from Kenneth Sr.'s secret offshore account. However, there's a bank auditor named Syed Bilal Ahmad who immediately catches on, which is something that I love, which now we'll see, is that everybody keeps talking about how charismatic and how charming both Sante and Kenny are. Mm-hmm. Yet every single time time they start doing something, they're almost immediately figured out.
Yeah. I don't think they're as charming. I think they're just charming enough to get away with like little stuff that people don't care about.
Yeah.
You know, like stealing a shopping cart of groceries or something. But when it comes to like.
Or slaves.
Or slaves.
Yeah. Or illegal immigrants. Yeah. Yeah.
Or cashing a bad check, which anybody could do.
Yeah.
So.
But when it comes to like the big stuff, like. Because I know that they say that they took this banker out to dinner. So that was their first big mistake, probably, is offering this banker like, oh, hey, we're going to take you out to dinner before we like withdraw hundreds of thousands of dollars from my husband's account. It's like no one takes their banker out to dinner.
Yeah. Yeah, nobody. And also a guy who's like already kind of suspicious, like, why are you here? And they're like, let me take you out to dinner and tell you why I'm here.
Let me show you a good time. Like, this is like Mad Men to them. They just think they're going to wine and dine their way to riches.
Exactly. Well, from that Larry King interview, one thing I learned is that I don't feel like they're exactly charismatic. I feel like what we've learned from this is that they are exhausted.
Exhausting.
Is that like from what when like the husband's never addressing anything to this Larry King interview, they are just, they literally beat you down. It's with
like, just shut the fuck up, take the money.
Yeah. Yes. You're literally just like, they think that if they just keep talking, they keep bringing up things, you're just going to be like, all right, I get, like they keep in the Larry King interview, she keeps telling Larry King, you promise me you're going to read the transcripts in that court trial. And he's just like, yeah, sure, I will. And it's just like, all right, I don't know what you need me to do. Like,
right,
and he's
lady.
Like, if I read the transcripts, what exactly am I going to find? And he goes, my innocence. And it's like, what? So it's just like, it's exhausting. So they take him out to dinner, right? Like you said, and he's never heard from again. But also they don't collect any money. So I feel like it's like, really, they just kind of killed somebody for no reason. So after the trial... So by the time the police in the Bahamas kind of caught on to the fact that this guy was missing, Kenneth and Sante were long gone. So after the trial of this other guy, David Kasdan, which we'll get to, Kenneth eventually confesses to these murders, and he says that his mother told him to murder Syed Bilal Ahmad because he was going to tip people off to the fact that they were taking out money.
Right.
So with the help of his mom, they drugged Ahmad, drowned him in a bathtub, and dumped his body offshore. So afterwards...
Just like that.
Yeah. So Sante denies any involvement or knowledge of the murders and claims that Kenneth's confession was solely to avoid the death penalty. Which is hilarious if you watch this Larry King interview, to see the two of them falling over themselves to be in love with talk about how great the other person is.
Right.
And then when they get to California and the death penalty's on the table, they immediately start attacking each other.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's the best part.
Well, except for, I mean, I'm sure you're going to mention it, what Kenny does to try to avoid his... Okay.
Yeah. So the next person that is involved in their crimes is David Kasdan. So basically what happened was there were a bunch of civil suits that came out of this involuntary servitude, the slavery trial, because they were housing people without, you know, not letting them leave. You know, that pesky thing.
Yeah.
So people were suing them for the work that they were doing. So what they were worried about was that their house in Las Vegas was going to be taken in this lawsuit. So family friend of theirs, David Kasdan, said, hey, you know, like every family friend does, hey, put my name on the deed. That way, they can't take your house, right?
But then, a good friend.
The old Willie Nelson method.
Yes.
Is that the Willie Nelson?
Willie Nelson, his trigger, his guitar.
Yeah.
He, when he had that big bankruptcy bullshit stuff, he lost his guitar at his daughter's house. Once he managed all his finances and stuff, they found the guitar again.
Oh. Would they have made him turn over his guitar?
They were. Well, I mean, because Trey, it's like his... iconic guitar is probably worth millions of dollars.
Oh.
This guitar he's had for years.
Yeah, I would have quote lost that guitar too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Along with like at least $250,000.
Yeah.
But, you know.
So he was like, but you guys are going to change my name back, right? And they were like, oh yeah. Yeah. It just went on for like 5 minutes, like deep stare eye contact. Yeah. And it was just like, okay. So then, unbeknownst to David, what they end up doing is they end up taking out a quick loan for $280,000.
Oh my God.
Then they decide that they're going to, now I don't know 100% how this works, but they take out a quick loan for $280,000. Then they burn down the house and they to collect insurance money. Right. Then they decide that they're going to change over the insurance policy to a man that they found outside, like basically a homeless man that they found outside of a Goodwill. So they convince him to change the name to that. So then they, because what they decide they're going to do is they're just going to take this guy.
Does homeless man have really good credit?
I guess so. I mean, no credit's better than bad credit, right? That's what I've heard.
Yep.
So then David Kasdan, unbeknownst to him, gets this paybook, which is like an old book they used to send you when you owed money. They would just say like, hey, here's like a payment plan we've already worked out for you.
Right.
So they sent him this paybook and they were like, hey, you have to pay back this $280,000. And he was like, wait, what? So he calls Sante and Kenny and he's like, hey, what the hell, guys? You told me years ago that you were going to take my name off this deed and you didn't. And now you've taken a loan out against me.
On David.
Yeah.
Like, I do feel bad that the conclusion is that he dies. They kill him. Right.
Yes. Yeah.
I do feel bad about that. But also, like, David's a fucking moron. Who the hell co-signs on a mortgage to a house?
Changes your name to a deed. Not even a mortgage, but you just...
To a deed.
You say, give me, I'll take the lien. I'll say I'm the owner of the house.
And then ignores it for years.
Maybe he had a little crush on Santee Kimes.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, it's
on
like
Sandy Chambers.
Yes. On old Sandy Chambers.
Yeah.
Maybe if I sign the deed over to the house.
Jesus.
Then, you know.
So,
but then he left it alone for years.
Yeah.
Years.
He
conned himself almost.
So then, he calls them. He says, hey, you guys got to come over here. We got to talk about this. So they go, okay. Well, then they go over there. They talk to him about it. Quote unquote, talk to him about it. They shoot him in the back of the head and they dump his body in a dumpster behind near LAX.
It's crazy. They were to the point now where like once you pissed them off, you were dead. You were a dead person. And she's in her 60s at this point.
Yeah.
Mm. And Kenny's like in his 20s, I believe.
Yeah.
And it's more terrifying knowing that she's in her 60s. And that's when the killing starts.
Yeah.
At least the first evidence killing.
Yeah. Because like one of the things that's scary is that Robert guy, he's at an IHOP and he calls from the phone at the IHOP and says, he calls the police and says, you guys got to get over here. These people have kidnapped me and they keep beating me up and they're not letting me go. And so Kenny runs over to him, sees the eyewitnesses say he sees that. He sees this guy, Robert, talking on the phone and goes, oh, I got to shut this down and goes over to kind of like essentially, you know, take care of him, but then realizes there's too many witnesses and him and his mom just run away. They just leave and they go to New York. So they flee to New York and they find this woman because they basically know through like just calling around and looking for places in New York. Sante was calling around pretending to be the secretary of a Manny Guerin and saying that she was looking for housing to place her boss. And so they find this rich woman named Irene Silverman who essentially was like one of the first Airbnbs because she would find like people who didn't necessarily have enough money to live in an affluent place in New York and she would kind of just let them stay
place. Because she was a socialite and a retired ballerina who had married
estate mogul.
Yeah. So now she had like all like this really nice place in New York and they basically decide to try to con her and her plan is to take over Irene's identity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Kenny comes and pretends like he's Manny Guerin. Which I feel like is a fake name that he made up where he was like, I'm a Manny Guerin. He's just like literally just making mouth sounds and came up with that.
I'm microphone water bottle.
Hello, microphone. And she was just so, and she was suspicious again right off the bat. She said that it was weird that they were like hugging the walls every mm-hmm. single time they came in to not get near security cameras. Oh. She would see his feet by the door. So it was obvious that he was like watching her whereabouts through the eye hole. Mm. So July 4th, she has this big party and she's like basically telling her maids and her staff, like, I don't trust this guy, Manny. He smells like jail. She says that.
Smells like jail.
And he has killer face.
Oh my God.
Which I gotta be honest, again, I don't mean to blame the victim, but I feel like, again, with this David guy, it's like hindsight's 20/20, obviously. Right. If one of your tenants smells like jail and has killer face, get rid of that guy.
Right.
Like,
right.
What? I don't understand why you would keep him around. Like, oh, but he makes the greatest knock-knock jokes.
Well, you're also like an old lady. She's an old lady. She's not going to assume. And she's a socialite, so she's always just been, you know, kind of taken care of and people are nice to her. So I would assume that she was just like, oh, nothing's going to happen. It's like, yeah. Nothing's going to happen to me kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So July 4th, she's talking to her servants, right? Then July 5th, nobody can find her. Mm-hmm. And that's not common. And that...
Because she doesn't leave the house.
She doesn't leave the house and she can't walk far.
She's the lady from Great Expectations.
Yeah. Basically. And she always has... She always has one of her maids go with her. And these aren't like slave maids. These are like actual like maids who like their jobs.
Yeah,
and
they're
like,
Swedish. Right. They're Swedish maids. Yeah, they're paid well.
They're like, she would adore this. Like, she can, like, literally, that's all they say the whole time, like during the one of the documentaries I started watching, they were like, she wanted to do this, she was so nice, like it's just like, okay. But anyway, so they immediately contact the authorities and they're like, no, there's no way that she wouldn't be gone, she wouldn't just vanish,
right?
So unbeknownst to just so completely
to that precinct,
yeah, to that precinct, they arrest Sante and Kenny leaving New York in a vehicle that they bought with bounce checks. So there had been a warrant out for their arrest in Utah and they were arrested for that. And when they were arrested, they found a bag with notebooks detailing like the crime that they committed against Irene. Not saying essentially that they would murder her, but basically detailing like her whereabouts. They had traced her name in cursive a bunch to practice forging her signature.
Right.
You know, basically saying all the things they needed to do, like get a social security card. They had a forged social security card of Irene's. They had her passport. They had unmarked $10,000 in unmarked bills. They had syringes. And so they find this
What's
bag.
What's with the syringes?
I don't... They didn't really mention it. They just said that they found syringes in the bag. Yeah.
That's the one thing the police planted just to make it look worse and throw everybody off. Like, what is this?
Yeah. And OJ's glove. Clearly, it was that time. But so then, immediately when they grab the bag, the police grab the bag, Sante immediately says, "We did nothing wrong." And Kenny pees his pants.
Oh. Like, immediately, police grab him, and it's just like, immediate soak.
Yeah. Which they were like, that was odd. I love that they said that. So they never find her body, right? And so they, even though David Kasdan's trial was murder what happened first, they were immediately tried for Irene Silverman's murder.
In New York.
Because
David was in California.
California, yeah. So they never find her body. And during the trial, they completely say that they're innocent. And Sante says that she was gag ordered because she wasn't allowed to testify, which wasn't true. It's just that she chose not to testify because the judge said that if she chose to testify, the prosecution could bring up her slavery charge.
Right. Yeah.
So
right.
She chose not to testify. So, and she kept trying to, like, she secretly handed a note to a reporter at the New York Times. She kept trying to influence the jury. She
What'd the note say? Go out with me.
Yes, exactly. Yes or no. Make I have matches. Will you be my fire? And then another thing was that, like, when they got arrested, they started, like, Kenny and Sante started doing really creepy things. Like, they would, like, hold hands during the court case. When they were being interviewed, they would, like, hold hands and they would, like, whisper sweet things. They would, in the court, they would whisper stuff to each other and giggle until the judge had to, like, basically tell them, shut up.
Yeah, like, this is they're a like give trap. Each other like creepy little kisses. Like, so they were obviously fucking before the trial. It's just like
Yeah.
At the trial, they kind of let it all out for whatever stupid reason.
Yeah. And it's really weird because, like, when they're asked about it in interviews, like, one time Kenny says, like, hey, like, that's just gross, but my mom's a sensual woman. It's just like, why?
My mom's a sensual woman.
So they were found guilty of Irene's murder, which was actually pretty interesting because there was no body. But because of all this evidence, they were found guilty. And they were also found guilty of 117 other crimes during this case.
Being icky.
Yeah. Well, incest is illegal, right? Yeah. But they weren't tried for that. They weren't tried.
Yeah. No. And they, so after that, they were sent to, they were due to be sent to
California
for David Kasdan's murder. So they started doing like interview after interview. They did Larry King. They did Court TV. And then all of a sudden, Kenny, when they're doing a Court TV interview, Kenny takes a reporter by the neck and puts a ballpoint pen up to her neck and says, if you have to promise me that you won't transfer my mom to California because she could if she goes to that trial and gets found guilty, she could face the death penalty. So he doesn't want her to even face the trial in California.
So he's going
to
kill his.
So he's going to kill the reporter unless they get a written thing that says you can't send my mom to California.
He's holding the reporter hostage.
Holy cow.
Like lime on TV.
For 4 hours.
Holy shit.
With a ballpoint pen. That's crazy.
Yeah, and the woman had interviewed him prior. She had interviewed him and
Without any
problems. And she even said, like, he was so nice until the moment that he took the ballpoint, he took her by the neck.
100% the mom told him to do that.
Oh, yeah.
100%.
If you look at the interviews that they do, each of them, it's like bullet points.
Yeah.
It's like the mom went over the way to talk and how to talk. And it's just like she dictated that entire thing.
It's really sad because that's what she did his whole life. Like somebody else in one of the documentaries says that kid never had a chance. Like she controlled him from day one. And she did that in every single way possible. She did that mentally, like physically, sexually. She never, ever had gave him a chance to have his own life.
Yeah. And so when they went to California, then that's when everything changed because that's when the death penalty was on the table. And that's basically when Kenny decided he's going to confess. But instead of getting a plea deal for himself, he gets a plea deal for his mom. So he confesses to the crimes, implicates his mom, says, hey, my mom told me to do these crimes, but you can't, you know, I did the crime, so you can't sentence her to death.
Yeah. Wow.
So he still saves his mom essentially. so he said, yes, we killed her. We killed Irene Silverman. We drugged her and then we strangled her and we threw her body in a river in a dumpster in Hoboken, New Jersey, which I feel like is just like, you know, that's just like a corner store in Hoboken, New Jersey. I've been there one time and I walked through and I said, this smells like an old woman's body deteriorating in a dumpster.
One thing we didn't mention is when the banker in the Bahamas disappeared, they left right away. And even though the authorities like suspected them, nothing ever happened to them for that crime. No justice was ever brought to that, like for that banker.
And they think that she might have killed one person by herself because when she left, when they left Hawaii and they moved back to Las Vegas, she had burnt the house down in Hawaii. And there was an accomplice that said that was kind of testifying against people in Hawaii saying, hey, I helped her burn that house down. And then he was never heard from again. And he was like essentially dead. Man. So,
well,
all right. Well, so that's
so she dies in jail.
She dies in jail. So they were both, they were basically half a century for Irene Silverman's murder and half a century for David Kasdan's murder.
Her release date was like 2119.
Yeah.
If it were, you know.
Yeah.
And so I think it's so arbitrary that they give you a release date when you have like 117 years.
Yeah. I would love to watch one person like count down the time and then actually get released because that may eventually happen one day. And it's just like, what are you going to do?
Yeah. Right. You said.
Yeah. I mean, people have been in prison for like 10 years now. Come out and are totally shell shocked by it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Like, oh, yeah, very true. What would they be like?
Oh, 120
years.
You know, hopefully we'll have a flying car by then.
So is Kenny still alive?
So Kenny's still alive.
Face the death penalty in California then.
No.
They gave him life?
They just gave him life, yeah.
Wow. Yeah, you're right. Wow.
So, yeah.
So that's the story of Sante Kimes and her son.
Kenny.
And there's a lot more info in the book, Son of a Grifter by Kent Kimes, who was
Kent Walter.
Oh, he changed his name.
Yeah.
Kent
Walker.
Which is her first son.
Her first son, yeah. And it's an interesting thing because, I mean, you could tell he still loves his mom, right. But he, like, is very much just like, she is a terrifying person.
Right.
So, I mean, I kind of feel, he's still alive. I kind of feel bad for him because, you know, I mean, it's like, you have to kind of go with the fact that, you know, you love, your mom was a great mom when she was with you, but then now she's like this, you know, sociopath.
Yes. All right. Cool. Michael, do you have any last words for Sante?
You know, I think, no.
I don't know. I'm trying to think.
She's a scary one. She's a mommy dearest.
Yeah. And again, this was going into this. I thought this was going to be one murder and this was going to be a woman who like essentially raised her son to kill somebody and that was it. And it's mm-hmm. like so much more.
Well, I'm just shocked that she only got 5 years for like owning slaves.
Yeah. Yeah. Why is that?
They were Mexican.
Okay.
Let's be honest.
They're also Venezuelan.
They're illegal.
They're lighter skinned.
Yeah, they're illegal.
Don't you guys care about them more?
We don't have a great history of caring about illegal people coming to our country. Let's
but
just
that's
be honest.
Nuts. I mean, she did it so many times. It's like she got like a month.
Well, it's
per
shocking
slave.
Just how long she got away with so many crimes mm-hmm. in general.
Yeah, I just think it's funny if she's just like, oh, I need somebody to fold towels. I keep forgetting. Okay, I'm gonna go to Mexico tomorrow.
Yeah.
Right, it's
so
a lot of like basically just shopping. Like be a slave trader.
Well, but that's a grifter in general. Is like, you know, she instead of like actually like hunkering down and like figuring out how to make money, she like forges social security cards, and it's like that just seems like so much more work.
I think it's about making that money or doing things on like your own terms and not mm-hmm. like playing by the rules. Like it's the same thing as like when I was a kid, I used to cheat on homework assignments and stuff by like photoshopping like stamps and shit like that. That took like tons of time and like ordering stamps online, and it took way more time than to just like learn how to spell Penelope.
What did stamps have to do with spelling Penelope?
Okay. All right. Well, so in high school, this is a detour. You can cut this out. But in high school, they had homework assignments, and the teacher was what they would do is they'd stamp your homework and then they'd stamp your calendar. And calendar, there'd be, they just at the end of the month, they'd be like, all right, there's like 16 stamps on here. You get 160 points. So what I would do, I wouldn't do the homework. I would I'd do like two or three assignments so I could get the stamp, what the stamp looked like.
Oh,
scan the stamp into
smart.
Photoshop, take out all the gray area, and then like kind of like change the color of the stamp and rotate it and stuff.
Yeah.
And then like print all those stamps onto a sheet of paper. And I was I did it.
Yeah.
Right.
That's awesome.
That is cool.
I used to Photoshop snow days, like the website that would have a snow day on it.
And then set it to your...
I would show it to my parents like, look, it's a snow day. I can't go.
Didn't you live in Southern California?
I lived in the high desert. So we would have like snow and ice days.
Oh, okay.
I know. I
That's
like,
crazy.
I got away with it way more than I should have because there was like 40 snow days a year in my world.
Like July.
Yeah.
I'm sure your parents were just like, as long as you're out of the house.
Yeah. And as long as they were just like, whatever.
Just get out.
Michael, do you have any shows or anything you want to plug coming up? This will come out today.
Detention, sketch comedy at the Pack Theater. We perform every second Sunday of the month.
Mm-hmm.
You can find me on Twitter at Pizza Scarston, Instagram at Pizza Scarston. That's pretty much out.
What's your favorite pizza?
What's my favorite pizza? You know, it's actually really sad because I'm lactose intolerant and I also have a gluten allergy, and that's both happened since
no.
I started my Twitter and my Instagram account, so I can kind of, I mean, I still eat pizza, but it's just really painful.
So you have to do like goat cheese, gluten-free pizza.
Right.
It's still good.
Yeah, it's still good.
All right. Well, check us out on Instagram and Twitter at Bloody Podcast. I know we've also been saying that we're coming out with a website, but I'm finally going to get to it this week. So we're going to be coming out with a website sometime within the next year. And then you can find me on Twitter at Lori Roggenkamp and at LROG on Instagram.
Yeah, you can find me at Felix and Furs on Instagram. It's pretty much the only thing I'm active on. And also look out for shameless advertising for a musical I have coming up called Bitty Bitty Bang Bang coming in March to the Complex, March 22nd and 23rd. So watch out for that. It's really great. It's a musical conspiracy about what if J-Lo killed Selena?
Ooh.
What? Yeah. Oh, I love that. All right. Well, yeah, let's definitely check that out. And thank you so much for listening. Have a great day.
Bye.
Bye.